transmitter sites. They can be dirty, nasty. They can also be pretty cool. They can also be freaking beautiful. Tony Dimsdale is our guest. He's from Greenville, South Carolina. He takes care of the Odyssey stations there, but he's been around the U.S. doing big installs with Gates Air. And we got some pictures to show you that are going to be really cool and lots of great advice. It's all coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support. Online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio. Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb right there that came from the top of a tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and delighted to be here. Here we are in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a wet, rainy day here in Nashville. There are thunderstorms about and moving across, but we're going to keep it bright and sunshiny inside. We got a great show coming up for you. You're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, and that's transmitter sites. I love transmitter sites, and plus a little bit of studio action and some amazing STL commentary from our guest. And well, without further ado, let's bring our guest right in here. Our guest is Tony Dimsdale from Greenville, South Carolina. Hey, Tony, welcome in.
Thank you, Kirk. How you doing today?
I am good. It's good to see you. You are at a station where I have visited a couple times, but I don't think I ever met you there at the station, did I?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think I've had the pleasure.
So give us a real quick rundown on who's Tony Dimsdale and what are you doing in Greenville, South Carolina?
I am currently the market chief engineer for Odyssey, the newly dubbed Odyssey, formerly Intercom Communications, in Greenville and Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Okay. And, you know, there's a rather well-known engineer who used to have your job, and that's Jerry Massey. What can you tell me about Jerry?
Jerry Massey was my mentor, the former SBE president and chief engineer here at this cluster of stations. He gave me my first shot in radio and saw a long-haired, flip-flopped kid and took a chance and kind of showed me the ropes and showed me how to not get shocked at an AM site.
He shows you where the electrons hang out, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, don't touch that. There's a lot of electrons right there. Kind of like bees swarming. You can't see them, but they're there. It's a dangerous thing about electrons. So Jerry, a lot of folks know Jerry because he's been president of the SBE, the elected president of the SBE, served a term or two. I'm not sure which, but
yeah. I think it was 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So good deal. Good deal. And Jerry's one of my favorites, a real gentleman, he comes across as a real Southern gentleman. You know, polite in his ways and paddling hard underneath, you know, he gets the job done.
Yeah. He left me some big shoes to fill. So we're trying.
I hear you. Now we're going to talk about transmitter sites today because that's one of your real passions, is talking about transmitter sites. I'll tell you what, give us one more quick look into your past. You ended up with a job for a while prior to this one that gave you an enormous amount of experience at transmitter sites. It was kind of a baptism by fire, wasn't it?
Yes. During the FCC repack, I was actually had a stint with Gates Air for about 2.5 years and did a lot of the installations across the country for the channel repack move, moving radio stations to aux sites in order to make way for TV stations and rebuilding TV stations for new frequencies and putting them back where they were originally on their new frequency. So a lot of that was trial by fire, and we didn't have a lot of time to shove a lot of work into the 3 years that they gave us. So it was fun while it lasted, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And it gave me a real heavy background very quickly in transmitter installation.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of folks like me who were not affected. I mean, I'm a radio engineer. In TV, I've been in front of the camera, but not much behind the camera. And a lot of us radio engineers don't realize all the upheaval, all the changes that had to happen during the TV repack. We think it didn't affect us, but there were lots of FM stations affected by this. What's the short story on, you know, the biggest affectations? Why did stations have to, FM stations have to do something about TV stations repacking?
Well, depending on the station, the tower space was a big ruling in a lot of it, because when you move the frequencies, the wavelength changes, so the antenna size is also going to change. So if you had two antennas butted back to back, or even in the same wavelength on a tower, they would actually have to move the FM to make new space for the TV transmitter. Also, there were loading issues. Some of the newer antennas were heavier because they were bigger, and so towers may had to be re-strengthened or taken down completely and a new stronger tower put up in order to hold the new load of the new antenna. So things of that nature, that would absolutely affect a radio station and be able to have to move it and still stay on the air is a big deal.
And even if a station could stay in the same place with all the tower work going on, I'm sure they'd have to go down and power up and power down. You know, whenever employees with tower climbers were near the FM antenna, they probably had to make changes there. And I guess for many of them, you mentioned aux sites, stations end up moving to their existing aux site, or maybe they arranged for a temporary aux site from which to transmit while the work was being done on the tower at their main site, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And all that has to be done in tandem with the project of the original station that you're contracted to move and rebuild for their new frequency and keep the other guy on the air too.
So I just wanted to give folks a background on why Tony Dimsdale has a good background in transmitter side engineering. We're going to get to some of your passions and peeves coming up in just a few minutes. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by my friends at Nautel. And you know, they do these Transmission Talk Tuesdays. Well, like many other things, they're taking a little break over the 4th of July holiday. But there are a couple of promotions from Nautel that are really worth paying attention to here. The first one is the free second backup exciter promotion from Nautel. You get a free second integrated redundant exciter on any GV series transmitter. Just contact your Nautel rep and go to the website. And by the way, they got a new website. Thank you so much for doing this. Nautel.com/offers. Actually, that's the website you're looking at right now on the video portion of our show. Nautel.com/offers. And the other offer is called the 4610 VS Savings Promotion. Yeah, I know that's a lot of numbers, but here are the facts. You have three offers in one here. You get $4,000 off the purchase of a VS 2.5 transmitter. That's a hoss, man. It'll go. I own one of those. Maybe I own two of them, I think. And you get $6,000 off the purchase of the VSHD Digital Exciter. Or you get $10,000 off if you purchase both. So those things you see on the screen there, the VSHD and the VS2.5, buy them both, get $10,000 off. Contact your Nautel rep or go to Nautel.com/offers for more information on that. The Transmission Talk Tuesday, as I mentioned, that's a roundtable discussion. They've been doing that for over a year now, helping us engineers out, giving us something to talk about, do, and learn from when we're under COVID restrictions. A lot of us have been staying at home. A lot of us are getting finally out back now, but the success of the Transmission Talk Tuesdays is carrying on. You can go, they haven't announced who's going to be on July 13th yet, but the next Transmission Talk Tuesday is Tuesday, July the 13th. You can always go to Nautel.com/webinars, Nautel.com/webinars, to find out more information. And as soon as they have it posted, it'll be posted right there. And we'll probably have something about that next week ourselves. But it's always worthwhile to get registered for those things. All right. Thanks, Nautel. Glad to talk about what's going on at Nautel with these two offers and the Transmission Talk Tuesdays. All right. Tony Dimsdale is our guest here on This Week in Radio Tech. We're going to jump right into some stories and information about transmitter installations. Tony, when you and I were talking about doing the show together, you told me that there are some transmitter sites, or there's at least one you mentioned, where you walk in, and I've almost felt this myself, but I haven't been to the site you're going to tell us about, where you walk into the transmitter site and it's almost like a religious experience. It's like, the heavens open up and here's all the equipment. And especially if it's bright, shiny, and new, and the floor is clean, you know, it looks really good. Tell me about your favorite transmitter site. Give us a vision of that.
My most favorite site is Lookout Mountain in Denver, Colorado. It's actually a lot of TV transmitters all in one, and they have multiple floors. Well, to get to the tower, there's a huge pipe that goes down inside the mountain, actually. And to walk to the tower, to the base, they're in the pipe, lined all the way around, are 6-inch copper lines, hard, rigid lines that go all the way around a stairwell. So imagine you're in the middle, and there are transmission lines all around you. And then at the base, a 2-foot stairs that just goes down into the mountain. It is a sight to see. It is beautiful. And I think when you and I were talking, I had mentioned it almost being like an organ at a church.
Much copper. Yeah.
It's just beautiful. It's absolutely stunning to see the engineering that goes into a system that can take a dozen transmitters and take them all to one antenna on one mountain. It's just gorgeous.
I don't think we have a picture of what you described there, but when you describe that, the stairwell and the transmission lines all around it, you know, the first thing I think of is Scotty from Star Trek in the Jeffries tube on the way up to the engine, right? With he's got stuff all around there, and he's always, you know, trying to fix something or disable something so the Klingons can't fly the ship. You know, it almost sounds like that. That'd be great to have a picture of an engineer in the stairwell. Is there in the collection you're going to show us? Is there a picture of that or not?
I don't think I have that one up. I may be able to find it and shoot it to you though.
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break here in just a bit, so you can have a look then. You mentioned also combiners and switchers, and you know, myself, Tony, I tend to take care of little small transmitter sites, you know, one or two transmitters there. In all my radio stations, I own exactly one combiner. That's it. And it's just a two-station combiner. So I don't have a bunch of switching and plumbing laying around, but I'm amazed at the plumbing. So I take it that a lot of the sites that you've done work at involved a lot of copper pipe overhead and installing it, cutting it to the exact size and so forth. And I want to talk about that for a little while so that if I ever do have a project like that, I'll kind of know what to look for, know what to look out for, and understand a little bit how to plan it. Why don't you spend a few minutes telling us about your impressions of a site where you got a lot of transmitters, maybe a combiner, switching apparatus, and the plumbing that goes into it that you enjoy doing so much.
Sure, absolutely. Well, every site's a little different. We've got a few sites here that use 3-inch line, 4-inch line, 6-inch line. So depending on the size of the line, you're going to have to make sure coming out of the transmitter, depending on whether it be a Nautel. We've got some GVs here and some gates here as well. They're all going to use the transmission line. Jeff, you mentioned the Transmission Talk Tuesdays, will make sure that the ferrite is on the output of the transmitter at every inspection that he goes to. He likes to say that has to be there. And I agree. I agree 1,000% that it has to be there. And then working out of the top of the transmitter, you may have a reducer. You may have something that's going to go from a 4-inch down to a 3-inch or a 3-inch down to a 1 5/8-inch, depending on the size of the line that you need for your power levels. So out of the reducer, you're going to either come with more transmission line out to elbows or to a coax switch, where the coax switch is going to be able to swap between multiple transmitters or multiple antennas, depending on the setup. So I've got some examples here of some of the pieces. I don't have all the pieces, but I've got some. Here is a bullet that's going to be out of the top of the transmitter that the actual energy is going to come out of and then come to the transmission line. This is a 4-inch bullet. This is used for our WROQ site. We have a MIAT standard 4-inch line there. There's a difference. Kirk, you and I had talked about a difference between 4-inch lines, inners.
I have to giggle at this. And by the way, I'd like you to show that again in just a minute. But you said the MIAT standard, and there's another standard. And to me, I get to use this line again. I love this phrase. That's the beauty of standards, Tony. There are so many of them.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So you MIAT said, has one, and dielectric has another.
So on 4-inch line, and now on smaller line, 5/8 any manufacturer, it's all this. You can interchange bullets. Some are better designed than others. Maybe some bullet brand or design that you like better, but any bullet for, you know, 5/8 line will work with any other line, 5/8 line. But you said specifically 4-inch line, in that size, there are a couple standards and you need to be careful about which bullet that you use. You need to stick with the same manufacturer probably.
Absolutely. Yes. They do make an adapter that will have one standard on one side and the other on the other to be able to change. However, mixing them without the adapter could be hazardous, loose connections or too tight of a fitting. So then later on, you may not be able to get that bullet back out, or you may end up with a burnout because the bullet may be too small for the line size.
Mm. Hey, if you could show that bullet again, let's, we've never gotten to talk about this in detail, and I have seen so many problems with bullets over the years, either from expansion contraction and, you know, scraping in there, or, you know, that's a good place for arcing to occur, or a split bullet upon poor installation. Why don't you take a few minutes and tell us the important parts of a bullet, no matter what size it is, it's got a, you know, a design that looks kind of springy. What should we know about bullets?
It's very easy to accidentally get your transmission line down in between some of these slots and be able to actually split this bullet all the way. I think you can tell how far down that goes, about 1/4 inch or less from the base of the insulator. So to be able to split it, yeah, absolutely. That would cause an arcing issue or potential issue for a burnout down the road. Maybe not immediately, but over time. And if moisture gets into the line, it would make it a lot worse.
Now, the white part in the middle, I'm guessing this is Teflon.
Yes, that is. It is, absolutely. And it actually comes off.
Oh, that one comes apart. Oh, okay. So I should know this. The bullet is actually one piece. It's a deceptive with the spacer on there. The bullet is one piece. Yeah.
And this will actually sit down inside of the field flange, and it will actually keep the pressure on, so that way there's no movement inside the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the bullet that you're holding in your other hand there, it looks like it's actually silver plated. Is it actually silver plated?
This is actually silver plated. It's for high temperatures. That way this will sit on a combiner coming out of the top of a ULXTE that burned up at WYFF, actually.
Some bullets are just copper or some alloy. Yeah,
they can be different materials. I know that some brass, companies are making inners that are aluminum now, lines, and those are a little more difficult to cut with the standard pipe cutters. But there's a couple of different options out there. I believe that the aluminum is lighter and cheaper, actually.
Probably so. Copper, I'm sure, plenty of high price there. But yet, now you mentioned about that silver bullet right there, not referring to the beer or any alcohol, but referring to that bullet there, right there. But you mentioned it's at the top of a combiner, and combiners do get hot. Rob Bertrand, a few episodes ago, reminded us of that the combiners throw off a fair amount of heat, or they may, depending on what they're doing. Is it important to use a certain bullet in certain places if temperature is a concern?
Absolutely, yes. They found that if you don't use a silver-plated bullet out of the output of some combiners, the standard bullets won't be able to take the heat load over time. So for this particular transmitter, this one was in service for about 6 to 8 months, I believe, on and off as a main or a backup during the repack, and it only lasted that long before it burned out. So 6 to 8 months on a brand new transmitter. So switching to the correct bullet, now they've been on for about 2 years with no issues.
Now I always thought bullets were just interchangeable, but apparently not. Not if you got a bullet that's in a specific place for a specific reason. And I suppose the design engineers who designed your combiner, whether that's ERI or some other company, and they also probably know the characteristics of the transmission line that you may be hooking it to, but I guess I never realized it's important to use the right bullet in the right place, or at least not the wrong bullet in the wrong place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's a smaller version. This is a 1 5/8. Now mm-hmm. this one will go inside of a coupler sleeve and it'll actually fit right down inside of there and it'll butt two lines together on either side and it'll be held together with hose clamps on both sides.
Ah, okay. That's 1 5/8. That's the size of 1 5/8 rigid. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Huh. I guess I didn't realize 1 5/8 rigid was that relatively small. It seems like the coax is a little bit bigger. You know, the corrugated heliax.
Yeah. And you can actually, this is normally what you would use either, you know, pre-gas barrier. A lot of folks don't use the rigid line going up the tower. They'll use this inside the building and then they'll swap right past the gas barrier to heliax.
Good deal. All right. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about when you do use rigid line inside or outside and when you can use I said the word heliax earlier. That's a name brand, but there's different name brands for the kind of coax that's spirally wound or got corrugations and you can bend it a bit. So that's all coming up this week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. It's episode 551. Tony Dimsdale is our guest. He's the chief engineer for Odyssey, formerly Entercom, Odyssey now, in Greenville, South Carolina. And so we'll be talking to Tony about transmitters, transmission lines, and field flanges, brazing, measuring stuff, and whiskey cups. That's all coming up. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store. You can get anything you need from them if it has to do with broadcasting. My goodness, they've got it. I was just talking to Buck Waters today at BGS. I mean, Buck, what a great guy. He'll get you the stuff you need, get you a quote quickly, tell you when it's going to arrive. One of the things that you get from BGS are products from Broadcast Tools. You know, Don Wingate has built an amazing company with so many different things that we need and use all the time from Broadcast Tools. And one of those things is the Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4. The Pro Mix 4, you wonder, why would I use a little mono audio console? Well, because you don't always need a stereo audio console. You want to go out to a live remote broadcast, have several people on mic, and maybe play some audio from, let's say, off of your computer? Well, you can do that with the Pro Mix 4. It's a compact and literally full-featured mono audio mixing console for perfect for almost any broadcast studio or going on remotes or for sports. Now, it's got three combination mic line inputs. So you can go in mic level or line level. It's got those really cute connectors to take a quarter inch connector or an XLR connector. It's got a dedicated fourth input that can be switched between either a balanced line device or the built-in USB audio interface. So you can play things from, like I said, from your computer. Through the USB interface. It has three of the quarter inch size stereo headphone outputs. Those have individual controls for volume, for mix and for pan. So you can mix the local mix or the return audio. So that gives you custom headphone mixes. It also has switch selectable program limiter. This is a really good idea for, you know, your remotes where, you know, the announcers may not be paying much attention to the levels and that limiter does a great little job. It's got the XLR program output. It has a monitor output for speakers. It's got muting and volume control on that. It has a mix minus output. So if you've got, let's say, from one of our other sponsors, if you've got the Angry Audio Bluetooth gadget, well, you can give it mix minus for your callers right there on site, whether you're in the studio or out on remote. It has that external phone hybrid. It also has an on-air relay for the relay light outputs. You can turn on an on-air light. So again, this is great for in studio. If you just need a voice track studio or something like that, works fantastic for that. Or going out to the ball games. Hey, our football season is going to be here before you know it. And then basketball season after that. And then baseball season after that. So if you need a reliable little mixer to take out to mix different announcers together, there you go. It's the Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4 from Broadcasters General Store. You can give them a call or you can visit them on the web at bgs.cc, but they're really set up to take phone calls at Broadcasters General Store at 352-622-7700. If you will jot that number down, put it in your electronic Rolodex or your contacts, you will thank me. 352-622-7700. When you get connected to Buck Waters, tell him I said howdy. All righty. Thanks a lot, BGS, for sponsoring the show. All righty. We're with Tony Dimsdale, chief engineer in the Greenville, South Carolina market for Odyssey. And Tony spent a couple of years on the road doing big jobs with Gates Air. And Tony, this is where you learned a lot about these kinds of things. Let's see, what was next in our plumbing? Oh, yeah. I'd like you to give us a little overview of thinking in 3D, right? Because I've seen some amazing combiner setups where there's just pipes everywhere. They don't seem to run into each other. Of course, that'd be bad if they did. How do these things become envisioned or built or worked on? It's got to be just a science of its own to make all these things fit in a room with a combiner.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just sent you a picture. I'm not sure if you're able to grab that. Oh, yeah. While I talk a little. So a lot of guys like to use the laser levels to try to make sure. A lot of times when you show up at some of these sites, they're not on level ground, or they're built on the side of a mountain, or sometimes it wasn't poured quite level. And so laser levels are one big tool that a lot of installers like to use to try to make sure that at least if you're going to set the transmitter level, your lines are going to be level, even if the walls aren't level. So that's one tool that a lot of people like to use. And you can get them now where they'll do 360 degrees all the way around the room, the ceiling, the floor, the walls, and they'll self-adjust to level themselves. So they make it a lot easier nowadays. But if you're old school like me and you don't always have the availability of a laser level, you can still use a tape measure. Plumb bobs and things of that nature to be able to reference if you're in the middle of the room and you know you need to go on this side of your transmission line 4 feet from the ceiling on each side. Hopefully the ceiling is pretty close to where you can get within an eighth of an inch and then try to level it out yourself. So that's one way, is using references. Yeah.
I was just thinking about references and the laser level and so forth. And it occurred to me that, you know, when you're plumbing things with, there's a lot of 90 degree elbows involved, and you can get, you know, 45, a 90 degree elbow, and you know, you can position them rotationally wherever you need to, you know, shoot a piece of rigid line, but they don't make an 87 degree elbow or a 93 degree elbow. You know, your corners, you know, you said, hey, even if the room isn't square or level, your pipes need to be. And that's because you don't want a pipe coming into an elbow at an angle that's 2 or 3 or 4 degrees off. That's bad for everything.
Absolutely. A lot of times what guys will do is they'll put two elbows back to back. So that way what you can do is you can come out of your transmitter and then directly into another elbow, and then you have that turning to be able to move it here or there wherever you might need to, up or down or side to side a little. And that's one trick that you can use.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. So the one coming out of the transmitter might be, you know, coming up like this, and so you can turn it wherever you want, and then you put another one right next to it but sideways, and then you could, if you had to shoot diagonally to get over to somewhere, that would let you do it, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. But at the other end of
also,
that,
they make 45s. You can use a 45 degree.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But they don't make a 47 degree or an 83 degree.
No.
Okay. You know, I've never had to put in a coax switch. Now, I've used them that other people have put in, and they've been actually put in pretty well. I didn't have any problems based upon a poor installation. But when you're planning a coax switch installation, what are the important things to think about?
It depends on preference. A lot of guys, personally, I like to be able to see the position of the switch knob to be able to tell if I'm in one or two. So I like to put mine with the bullets facing up towards the ceiling. And that way I know that my elbows or my transmission line aren't going to over time sag coming out of a coupler sleeve or anything of that nature. They're sitting flush against a flange of the coax switch, so they're not going to move. Also, you can see the knob to where you can get to with a crescent wrench if you have to manually adjust the coax switch. And you can see which position you're in without having to get a ladder out and climb up into the ceiling, things like that. For me personally, I like to see them with the bullets up. As far as hanging it, I like to build a frame out of Unistrut to support it and then hang it from the ceiling with all thread. That way I can put it in a position where I want to, up and down on the all thread, and lock it in place.
I was going to ask you, I've seen some of them hung up with chains and others with all thread. You prefer the all thread because you can finally adjust that and lock it where you want it, huh?
Absolutely. Yes. And the nut on each side, on the bottom and on the top of the actual coax switch.
Okay. Okay, man. That can be a lot of mechanicals to think about right there. Field flanges. I think I know what you're talking about. I haven't had to do much of this plumbing. I mean, I may have cut 5 pieces of rigid in my entire life. I've done a lot of the Heliax stuff, but not the rigid stuff. Talk to me about dealing with rigid line. Oh, there you go.
So, here's a 1 5/8 slip flange. This will actually butt up to the transmission line on this side. And this is the hose clamp that will actually tighten around the outer of the transmission line. And you'll be able to crank that down. There's a torque specific setting for every single line size. 3 1/8 is 80 pounds, I believe. And don't quote me on that, though. I'd have to look it up, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But then this will butt up to whatever you might need, a gas barrier or another field flange, like on a coax switch or a patch panel, if you have one designed like that. And then the inner will actually poke through to the bullet here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. 1, 2. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
My mic went away. It's back now.
Uh-oh.
Sorry.
All good. So that's the slip field flange, and these will actually butt up perfectly to the gas barrier to where we were talking about switching to flex line or Heliax, Andrew, things like that.
How I noticed that the field flange, like the one you've got right there, you what do you call it, a slip flange?
This side here is a slip. Yep. And okay. That'll slip right. I call it a slip because it'll slip right over that transmission line. Very similar to the coupler sleeve.
Yeah. Now, you showed the hose clamp on that one, but I think you told me earlier that some of these need to be brazed on in the field.
Yes, you can actually get these. I'm going to try to get it a little close. You can see right there where you have a little bit of solder, where the copper meets the brass.
Right.
And so some of these will come without this copper piece, and you'll be able to slip the transmission line directly down into the copper and be able to braze it, or a lot of guys, silver solder that in place. And then you can actually have this with your transmission line attached to it.
Okay. All right. So you really would be attaching that in the field, but you got to have what kind of tools does it take to do that? What kind of acetylene setup?
I use a number 4 torch head with a oxy acetylene torch. You can, I think Northern sells them, or I think you can buy empty tanks online, and then most welding shops will fill up the gas for you at the welding shop. And then it takes a special brazing rod, also sold at the welding shops as well.
What would you ask for? To tell them the metals you're brazing?
Yeah, you can tell them exactly what you're doing. You can do copper to brass, and they'll tell you exactly what you need usually. And there's a couple of different styles depending on the chemicals that are in the brazing rod that will work. Some are better than others, but I've never had an issue with those.
Now, we've been talking about rigid line. Go ahead.
Sorry. Some of them will come with rings inside, actually. And the ring inside, you just have to heat it up and it will marry to the transmission line if you flux it. And then the ring will actually melt inside.
Nice. Okay. That sounds cool. Rigid line versus flexible line. Now we know that going up the tower, there's typically choices there. You wouldn't use rigid line in the 1 5/8 size category, but when you get up in larger lines, you know, I guess the benefit of a rigid line is if you have a burnout, if there's a problem down the road, some years down the road, you can replace just part of the line unless there's soot that's gone everywhere. Whereas with a flexible line, you may have to replace the whole thing or do a mend on the tower, and that can be messy and can result in problems down the road. Talk to me about when you use rigid and when you use flex, and then what your options are inside, where you're not trying to hold pressure inside. Obviously, the things you've been showing us there, the field flanges, those don't hold pressure, at least not the one you showed us.
No, these won't hold pressure. And if they would, there would be a actual gasket here, and you would see the red, normally red or orange gasket that would sit deep inside here, and it would actually marry up and pressurize that line.
Gotcha.
For the flex line versus the rigid line, I like the flex line. There are some instances where the rigid line would be better for higher power levels. Just for instance, RWRQ here in the area has a GV Nautil 60, and mm-hmm. the 60 is a very high power. So we actually have a 4-inch line that's rigid with 17.5-inch sections to help with the efficiency of that specific frequency on that tower. We have an auxiliary line that's a backup flex line that will not do as high of a power because it's only a 3-inch line. So our auxiliary would have to go down in power on the auxiliary antenna. Or the main transmitter would have to go down in power for the aux antenna. So the normal TPO would be over 40 kilowatts for the rigid line at a 4-inch, which is pretty big in FM. But on a 3-inch line, you may only want to run 20, 30 kilowatts, somewhere around there. And you could do a 3-inch, either rigid or flex or both. You could do a transition.
Is there any difference in the power rating of rigid versus flexible line for a given size of line?
Every line will have its own max power rating. So what you can run into it. Some of them will be pretty close to each other, but they're all going to be a little different. Flex line is a little more, no pun intended, flexible as far as where you could use it. Meaning it's not frequency dependent, or you could use it at different power levels for different frequencies. Whereas some rigid lines, you can only use certain links for certain frequencies.
Right.
For instance, we were talking about the repack before. Some of the TV transmitter sites that we were at, when they channel changed, they also had to change their entire transmission line along with their antenna because certain lines will only work for certain frequencies.
And that's just because the buildup of VSWR, when you have these transitions at regular intervals, if those intervals are close to a wavelength or a integer portion of a wavelength, then
exactly, yes, you'll end up with a standing wave ratio at a point in that line that you may not want it, which will cause a burnout or cause a weak point in the line to be able to have issues down the road.
Gotcha. All right. Hey, coming up, we're talking to Tony Dimsdale, and he is the chief engineer at the Odyssey Stations in Greenville, South Carolina. We've got more coming up, including talking about Whiskey Cup, I promise that, and mistakes that people make when they're putting transmission line, like me, cut too short, bad mistake. And so plus we got some talk coming up about remote controls and studios, but also want to look at some pictures. Tony brought along some great pictures, and we're going to be getting to those. Hey, a quick heads up for our producer, Suncast. I forwarded an email to you that does have a picture in it, and maybe sometime in the next few minutes we could actually hit that picture first when we come back from our announcements. This Week in Radio Tech, I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends over at Angry Audio. This is the Angry Audio Bluetooth audio gadget. I mentioned that earlier because, of course, it works with the Broadcast Tools ProMix 4, because this is an interface to your cell phone, and it does it with Bluetooth. but it does it in two different ways. One way is, you know, the quality that you would expect from a cell phone, two-way audio, low delay, and lets you carry on or take your conversation and run it over to your audio console, speaking to your caller through the audio console, and then having your caller's audio come into the audio console. So if you're doing a podcast, if you're doing a remote broadcast and you want to bring callers into that broadcast, you can do it with this and any audio console. The other way you can use this, though, is if you've got some high quality audio on your phone. Let's say you recorded an interview or you have some songs, some kind of music, you can, and that's on your phone itself. Well, you can play that back through here. And because of the Bluetooth standard, the Angry Audio Bluetooth audio gadget and your phone both kind of know what you're going to do. Are you carrying on a phone call or are you pushing one-way audio from your phone into this? If you're pushing one-way audio, then the highest quality codecs are selected. And typically that could involve the aptX algorithm. And you're going to get high quality audio stereo, 20 kilohertz audio from your phone through the Bluetooth audio gadget. And it's got connectors on the back, of course, to hook up to your audio console. It's got analog and AES connections right there. The other thing that Angry Audio has for you, and you know I love this, are the Studio Hub adapters. There was a rumor back a couple of years ago that Studio Hub was going out of business, closing their doors, and they did. But Angry Audio negotiated with them and bought all the jigs, made arrangements with the factory, bought all the intellectual property here, and the name, Studio Hub. So Studio Hub exists. You can get them easily through your broadcast dealer, and they are coming to you via the folks at Angry Audio. So whatever your favorite adapters are, I like these myself. They let you put any length of Cat 5 cable you need. Could be, you know, just a little 1 foot Cat 5 cable, or run this, you know, halfway across the radio station, 100 feet or so, and get you balanced audio there. Also carries AES EBU audio. You can buy an adapter that's already set up for that, because it's just one pair goes through there to the XLR connector. And you can also buy them in this format where the male XLR is already there, and then you buy the length of cable that you want to go to your professional broadcast device. They got all the Studio Hub stuff at Angry Audio. Go to the website, angryaudio.com. Plus, you'll see all the other gadgets, like the Call Me codec family, the Bluetooth gadget, the Failsafe gadget, and all the Studio Hub gear. Plus, I got a little word from a bird that they got some new products coming out, something that somebody should have thought about a long time ago for us broadcasters. I can't tell you what it is, but I can show you in a few weeks. So that's coming up. You stay tuned, because Angry Audio never rests, always coming up with new stuff. Hey, our show is also brought to you by our friends at Max Connect Wireless. And here's a quick announcement. We'll be right back.
With all of the recent cybersecurity attacks against large corporations, we were looking for a product that would give us the ultimate in security at our transmitter sites and as well as with our broadcast equipment. Max Connect fits the bill very well. Its greatest security feature is the fact that it gives you a single static IP address. Using this single static IP address allows us to close hundreds of open ports on our firewalls across the company and restrict access to only the Max Connect IPs. This has greatly reduced our exposure to the World Wide Web and made us much more secure moving forward. It's also given us the ability to expand as needed in a secure fashion.
Thanks, John Takak, and this is what he's talking about. This is the Max Connect Wireless. Available in a variety of different form factor modems. This one happens to be the PepWave modem, and you put a couple antennas on there for diversity on your cell signal, and right out here, out comes your IP with a fixed IP address. Really cool. Works in all kinds of places. Hey, I've used these for the show, doing the show itself. And I've also used them when the internet was down at my radio station because a tornado took everything down. We used Max Connect and had plenty of internet. Check it out. Max Connect Wireless. You can go to actually, they've shortened the URL, maxconnect.com. It's spelled funny. Take note or wait. Click on the link on my website in the show notes. maxconnect.com. Thanks a lot, Josh Bone, for doing such a great job providing something that broadcasters really, really need. All right, it's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 551, and Tony Dimsdale is my guest. He's the chief engineer over at the Odyssey Stations in Greenville, South Carolina. I'm Kirk Harnack in the TELUS Alliance studio, and we're going to talk a little bit more about, well, I'll tell you what, you know what we ought to do? If Suncast has it, Suncast, I emailed a picture to you, and it was something that Tony had talked about, Just let me know when, or just pop it up when you've got that ready, if you could. Oh, there it is. There it is. Thank you, Suncast. Tony, what is this glory?
So this is the pipe that goes from the building on Lookout Mountain and goes down to the base of the transmitter site. And this is what we were talking about before, where you can see so much copper all around you at the transmitter sites. And these are coming out of various transmitters or combiners at Lookout and going down to the base of the tower to go out to the antenna systems. And then you can see, you know, the Ice Bridge catwalk and how much space you actually have to walk in between these transmission lines.
Wow. Somebody had to really think about that. I mean, what kind of board meeting was that? All right, you want your tower here? We got to drill a big old hole in the mountain.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just think about the planning for this. That's pretty cool. That is pretty cool. Huh. All right. We're going to have some more pictures coming up in a few minutes. Right now, Tony, mistakes. I'm sure you've come to transmitter sites that you were charged with, you know, making some changes, making some improvements, maybe replacing everything. What do you see engineers have done that maybe they ought to avoid? Maybe they didn't know better or whatever.
Well, there's always learning mistakes and there's always growing pains, budgetary restraints or things of that nature to be able to try to work around. Engineers, have to contend with a lot of things. A few things to note are electrical parameters to be able to make sure that your breaker box has enough capacity to be able to take the new transmitter that you're installing. I've been to some sites where we've shown up for installations and there needed to be a new transformer install to step down from 480 down to a 208 to be able to actually run the transmitter. The newer transmitters today that Gates Air puts out or Nautel do not run at 480. Inherently, they will do anywhere from 190 to 260. But if you have a 480 volt service, you may have to have a step down transformer feeding a separate breaker box for that transmitter. So things like that. Also HVAC, make sure that there's enough cooling if you have just an air-cooled transmitter. With the Gates Air, you can do an air-cooled FAX 30 or 40, but you can also do an FLX 30 or 40. So going into that, knowing what you have versus what you're going to need after the purchase of the transmitter is vital, because if you need an FLX, you may not need as much cooling for that versus an FAX or an air-cooled transmitter to be able to do the installation. And little gotchas that you may run into, specifically with cutting lines, measure, you know, twice, cut once. Make sure that when you get on site that you, A, have enough to do the job that you need and you don't need to go back to the hardware store or call your guy back and order some more. But if you get there, measuring twice and cutting once is best practices to be able to try to ensure that you're not going to have to get your pipe stretcher out and try to make it work or use a couple of these guys in line to try to put stuff back together like a puzzle piece, which can cause reflection down the road. So that's a couple of things, specifically for transmitter sites.
Gotcha. Hey, one question about rigid line used inside. So you're cutting it to length, and then you're going to put a field flange on the end of it. Of course, when you cut through it, well, first of all, what kind of saw do you typically use? I mean, I can't imagine that a handheld saw is going to do a good job on that. You probably want something that's going to make a nice, very straight cut, right?
There's a couple of techniques. I wish I had my cutters with me here today. There are pipe cutters that go, we'll use this as an example. This is a piece of transmission line that's actually stuck on this bullet. It's actually melted to it. So Ooh. You can get a pipe cutter that will run around the outside and it will actually scar the copper and it'll indent it as it goes around. And every time you go around, it goes down a little further. There's a little knob on the end of it that you will twist, and it will actually tension up more and tighten, and you'll be able to eventually get this guy off and cut it off. And then you're going to use a deburring tool. The deburring tool is very similar to electrical conduit. You'll deburr the inside of this. You'll maybe use some Scotch-Brite on the outside of it to clean it up and make sure that it's nice and clean before actually installing it. That's up to a certain size. They don't make them for larger sizes, 10 inch, 12 inch. It gets a lot harder. The pipe cutters do what I like to call catwalking, and they will actually start just kind of shifting down the end of the line, and you'll end up with kind of like a candy cane effect going down the line. For that instance, what I like to do is I'll take two hose clamps that are larger duct size hose clamps and put them as close as I can together and use a reciprocating saw to, and have another gentleman at the site twist the pipe for you as you're cutting. So that way you can cut inside the hose clamps and someone else can turn it for you. And then eventually you'll meet back up where you started.
You know, I promised that we would look at some pictures here, and I realize our time is slipping away. So why don't we jump into some of these pictures from transmitter sites, Tony, and have you give a quick description. What are we looking at and what may be significant about what we're seeing here? These are all from your website, which is called DimsdaleTech.com. Go ahead and narrate for us quickly.
This is a GV40 that we installed in 2016 for WTPT-FM. It was FM only when we actually started this one, but today it's actually FMHD. So the legends you plot doesn't look like a composite anymore, and the spectrum actually has sidebands on it now. But this was a brand new installation that we had put on in 2017. This is actually Jerry and I's one of our last projects that we did together.
Cool. What's next?
This is a Continental 816. I think this is, we just replaced the tube in this one, actually. It's a 4CX 20,000E tube series, so it has the retrofit kit. And this guy's running at about 30 and a half kilowatts, depending on the efficiency factor that you use for the calculation. This is actually part of a split level combined system that is using a Z16 HD to produce a couple kilowatts of digital signal for this station, WSPA-FM actually. And this was with a brand new tube actually doing a burn in within the first 200 hours. We just turned that guy back down actually the beginning of this week.
Man, that plate voltage is what, just about 10 kilovolts there, isn't it?
yeah.
Wow. And about 3.7 amps of DC power. That's a lot. It's a lot of power there. All right. What's next? Suncast.
This is actually a station in Ohio. This is a Z16, two Z16s actually, running one FM and one HD. And this is a FAX 20 that's going to replace both of these guys actually. And what we were doing is a FlexStar upgrade to a FAX 50 upgrade, and taking it HD actually. So you can see above the little card there on the front of it, the business card, there's a 2RU FAX 50 exciter and three black spacers above and below. Those are to fill the spaces that actually the Flex Stars came out of to make room for this FAX 50. So that was, I don't remember the call letters of that one, but that was a site that Richard Henkamper and I did together in Ohio, and we did the whole upgrade and took it to FMHD, recalibrated the entire transmitter, power blocks and forward power, reflected power and airflow, and then went back to Quincy. That was a fun job, actually.
Cool. Looks clean too. What's next, Suncast?
This is an HT20. For WYRD-FM, actually. Fun note, the digit in this exciter, the digit exciter in this transmitter died, and I actually had to send it back to Gates while I was here at Intercom the first stint, and I had to run this transmitter with an 802B Continental transmitter, actually. And I didn't know you could do that at first, but as long as you jumper the AFC and the RF mute, it doesn't care. RF is RF. So that was a fun job, actually. And this guy actually is due for a tube change, actually. So I'll have some more pictures for that one coming up in the next couple weeks for you, Kirk.
Good deal. You put new tubes or rebuilt in something like that?
It depends. It depends on the life of what we've been running in it. I'll usually do a couple of stints of used tubes and then recheck the price of used tubes after a few years. The one that we just put in for WSPA for the previous Continental was a used tube.
Okay. Next picture.
This is actually a GV60. I'd have to ask Jeff, but I want to say, and I don't want to be too presumptuous, this might be the only GV60 series in the States, actually. This is WROQ. What it is two narrow 30 cabinets combined with a dual output exciter. And it has an external combiner from ERI that you can see up top. And then we put some ducting behind it because, like we talked about before, the air conditioner load was a little lag on this site. So we had to duct some of the air outside rather than upgrading the HVAC inside.
What a good idea. So take part of that hot air and just and run it outside, which does mean that you're going to be pulling air in from the outside that you've got to cool. But it's presumably it's cooler than the air you're throwing outside.
Absolutely. And in the winter, you can cut the louvers and warm your lunch that way, too.
There you go. Next picture.
This is a Fax 3.5K. This is actually a backup auxiliary transmitter that we use for WFBC FM here off of our esteemed Hogback Mountain in Greenville, South Carolina. It's the highest point we have in Greenville, South Carolina, actually. And this guy, from that height, will cover almost as well as a Class C. This is about 3,000 foot up high, feeding into a three-bay Shively. And so we don't get a lot of gain out of that, but the transmitter power is about 3,800 watts. And we don't get a lot of complaints off of that one when we have to do downtime on the main site. So I've been pretty impressed with that.
Let's set up a couple more pictures here. Suncast, what's next?
This is a firmware update I was doing on a VS300 for 97.7 on Paris Mountain here in Greenville, South Carolina as well. That's our ESPN Upstate affiliate here in the Upstate. The latest, gotcha. I think, we had to do a couple of jumps on that one. I want to say we did three rounds of OS recoveries on this guy. It was a little out of date.
Yeah, I got several to do that are all way out of date. What's the next picture?
This is a Z16 that we did the C11 caps on the power amplifiers on all 16. So after about a decade or so, you see amp faults in the controller because the dielectric caps, I want to say I'm saying that wrong, the capacitors on the power amplifiers themselves start to dry out and they need to be replaced. So this was a project that we were doing, trying to get this guy back up to service bulletin worthiness and be able to actually have it caught up on all the latest and greatest updates, firmwares, and service bulletins.
And that screen is showing HD signals without the presence of the analog FM.
Yes, this is actually another split level system for WFBC on Caesar's Head Mountain here in Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay. Next picture.
That looks like a big gallery of a lot of them.
That should be what Suncast is trying to get to the next picture. Maybe it's not wanting to go. There we go. That's the one I wanted. Let's go back to the one with lots of transmitters.
This is a site. I'm not going to mention the call letters for this one, but this is a pretty interesting site in Atlanta, actually. This has got a large vintage of different transmitters.
It does.
And they all actually still are powered up. They don't all run, but the Z16 is actually on the air. And to the left of the Z16, there are actually two combined HPXs as well. Which is a very infamous transmitter that a lot of engineers really, really love. And then we've got an HT20 and an even older vintage. I want to say that that's a Continental or a Collins back there in the back.
Good deal. Let's do just one or two more pictures and then we're going to take our final break. Oh,
This is grounding at a specific site for a dummy load. So grounding is lightning protection for the equipment at the transmitter site, and mm-hmm. all the electrical grounds and the equipment grounds all come back and bond to the transmitter for safety and for protection of the equipment at most all transmitter sites.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that looks like some 4-inch copper strap there. Maybe that's
a little bit less. Here's some 2-inch grounding strap. This is actually for a TV transmitter site that we were adding a new frequency, and we were silver soldering this 2-inch to the existing 4-inch to add a new ground strap for a new transmitter that was going in.
We are out of time to look at any more pictures. Maybe we'll pick one more to go, but my friend Tony Dimsdale is with us here. He's the chief engineer at the Odyssey stations in Greenville, South Carolina. And we're going to come back with Tony and have a tip or something that's really on his mind to leave you with, some advice to leave you with. And to me, the whole idea of the RF plumbing, it would be best to have somebody knowledgeable to show you how to do this. Now, I'm the kind of guy, once somebody shows me the important things, I'm going to get it. I'm going to be kind of good at it, but figuring out myself, I'm going to make some mistakes. So maybe Tony, when we come back after this break, Tony can tell us about, you know, what are the important things to pay attention to, or find you a good Elmer, as it were, to walk you through it. Somebody like me needs that. This Week in Radio Tech, episode 551. I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, one of our sponsors is Broadcast Bionics, and they are so expert at getting your radio station, your broadcast facility, into the mode where you can publish on social media quickly. You can take the things that you do in the studio and make them all better and put them out there to the public. And Camera One is one of those ways of getting that done. An amazing product from Broadcast Bionics. Let's check it out together.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics, designed to bring video to your audio content, visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system, using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot, and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's Red Lights Fire IP or an Avantek Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good-spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
Only thing they have at Broadcast Bionic, you should check them out at bionic.radio. Bionic.radio. They have an incredible array of tools, hardware and software, to make your broadcasting better and connect you with your audience. Thanks a lot, Broadcast Bionics, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. With Tony Dimsdale here to the final moments of our show. Tony, I'm sorry to put you on the spot here. I don't think I warned you, but that's typical for me. I forget about that. If you had to leave our viewers and listeners, engineers like you, like me, with some advice, what tip would you leave them with to help them do a better job?
I would advise them to join the SBE, honesty. If they join the SBE, they've got a lot of good learning tools and a lot of good programs to try to help young engineers who are learning, and programs to try to put them with veteran engineers to learn and grow. I think that it's a great tool. I think that it's a great opportunity for young engineers to come in and try to learn something from a more experienced engineer.
Good idea. Good idea. And if people want to join the SBE, no matter where you are, you can go to SBE.org and you know, find out where the chapter is nearest to you. Get in touch with SBE. They'll be glad to help you out. One of the things that, if I could dovetail on what you said, is that you can find out so many techniques and technologies about broadcasting by watching SBE webinars. And so you can join SBE, something called the Member Plus program. I'm a member of that. You pay extra, but then you get to watch or participate in all the webinars. Webinars at SBE typically cost per webinar. You can choose the, you know, it's not a high expense, but you can choose the ones you want and pay a la carte. But if you join SBE Member Plus, then you get access to all the past webinars, and that's free, or no additional cost, I should say. And the same thing for new webinars that are coming out. And myself and some colleagues at TELUS Alliance are doing some webinars coming up. We're doing that in collaboration with folks from Tyline and Comrex. So yeah, you can learn a lot. Tony, the only thing that scares me about dealing with rigid line is cutting myself, because I have cut myself with a box cutter knife and with a hacksaw. Somehow I managed to really lay it into myself. So, do you wear gloves typically working with the stuff? How do you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially with cutting or with brazing, always. Mm. And also safety glasses, helmets, if available. PPE is very important in the field. Absolutely. Unfortunately, a lot of engineers find themselves by themselves sometimes out in the field. And so safety is definitely key. A lot of guys I've seen will wear kitchen cutlery gloves when they're doing cutting of the pipe, things of that nature. You cannot cut through those gloves. So even if the blade does come up to your finger, it's going to stop on that glove. And then also heavier duty type heating gloves that firemen would wear for brazing or torches of things of that nature.
I will tell you, I've got all my digits here, so I didn't cut anything off. But I will tell you that if you're at a transmitter site and you're foolish like me and you don't have a first aid kit, and you're foolish like me and you cut yourself because you weren't being very careful, you can actually use toilet paper, which may exist at your transmitter site, and electrical tape to make a bandage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Ask me how I know.
Yeah, I've had to use sock and duct tape. Absolutely.
Sock and duct tape. Tell the emergency room, well, I put this on, but I don't have a sock on my left foot.
Don't mind the smell. Just stitch me up.
That's right. Tony, it's been a delight to talk to you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for sharing the pictures with us, especially the one from Denver, from that looked like a Jeffries tube on Star Trek.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kirk. It's been a blast.
That's good. Oh, and if people want to check out your pictures, you got a website. Tell us what that is.
It's dimsdaletech.com, dimsdaletech.com. We also have a Facebook page, Dimsdale Technologies on Facebook, and all the contact information is there.
Okay. I will put links to those in today's show notes for today's show. How about that? Tony, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate you being here. Again, you're welcome back anytime, but good to see you, and I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you, sir. You have a good one.
All right, Suncast, thank you for producing the show. Suncast has been behind on the controls here, as he is in every show. Thank you very much, Suncast, for being here. And Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find other cool podcasts. Check it out at gfqnetwork.com. All right. All right, we got to go. We're going to see you next week for another good show on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.